Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Welcome to Three, a show about Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic, and part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm Gil Gross with Joel Drucker and Amy Lundy. And on today's show, we will do some suffering. That's not really true. We're not going to suffer, but we're going to talk about suffering in honor of clay court season. The rallies will get longer, and one of our three, Rafael Nadal, will tell you, in order to succeed on this surface, it is essential. You must suffer. But first, let's go over the Monte Carlo draw to kick off clay court season. Djokovic and Nadal are both in it. Nadal on the bottom half of the draw, Djokovic on the top half, so they can't possibly meet until a possible final. But Amy, takeaways from the draw?
Yeah, it didn't look like the early rounds presented much of a problem. I think Djokovic has either Sinner or Ramos Vinolas. Ramos Vinolas is a great clay court player, but let's remember, guys, that this is Novak's home club, basically. This is where he practices, and the tournament officials said that the guys who live in Monte Carlo are allowed to stay at their homes. So it'll be should be very comfortable. And of course, Nadal has won there, I think, 11 times. So it's almost like his home club.
But Sinner isn't. I mean, the Miami Open finalist is not particularly comfortable as a second
round.
Well,
you know, I was thinking, like, which players would have more of an advantage? The guys that played in Miami and have played, you know, a big tournament, a Masters level tournament more recently, or the guys that kind of stayed in Europe and started working on clay? I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, if I were to guess, I would say the guys that were working on clay, but we'll see.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, so here's Sinner, had a nice run in Miami and playing well. Of course, he's in ascent, and we're going to see. Remember, he got to the quarters of Roland Garros just last fall. So curious to see how he does at playing Novak. It's great to the Monte Carlo-ness of Nadal. You got the club champ and the club member, who's also won it some too. So they're each very, very familiar with that venue. And there's a real intimacy to that venue that people like. And kind of interesting, of course, the big start of the European clay. I mean, it's just, it'll be interesting to see how Novak is. Neither he nor Nadal has played in a while. So I'm fascinated.
The highest seed in Djokovic's quarter is Alexander Zverev, who won Acapulco a couple weeks back, but then had a surprising first round loss in Miami. I think clay is Zverev's best surface. That's my personal opinion. Nadal has, as you said, a really what looks like a cushy section, and his seed is Andrei Rublev opposite him, who I just feel like that would be straightforward if they met on a clay court. But yeah, you know, I'm not really trusting Djokovic or Nadal these days at the start of a long layoff as they begin their rounding into form before a major. Like, the results have not been that consistent in this spot as of late.
Well, and then we also have the whole world we live in, and so of the pandemic still. And even though things are getting better in some ways, the sequencing of how the year goes and how players build upon results and confidence and training is so out of whack, because some players did play Miami and then they're coming to Europe, but then there's the stressful aspect of the pandemic. So I think in most situations, say, well, gee, having played Miami, doesn't matter what the surface, your tournament tough, and let's go on to Monte Carlo. But now you're right, some of these players have been training more on clay, so maybe does that help them? And it's going to be very, very interesting.
Well, as a fan, I would admit that I want to see Sinner Djokovic as a spectator. I want to see him trade backhands. That's what I want to see. I mean, how would we compare the Djokovic and the Sinner backhand right now? I think Jannik Sinner's backhand, give it a couple years and it'll be one of the best ground strokes on tour and the best backhand on tour.
Well, he's the young Turk in the law firm, isn't he? I mean, he gets so much racket head speed, and it's kind of like a new iteration of the software, because you see how hard he hits it and how flat. And obviously the likes of Agassi and Djokovic have led to Sinner's progress with it. The shot he knows he needs to hit if he wants to thrive in pro tennis. I mean, they raise the bar. So now I think it's still kind of raw. It's still coming together.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that Sinner will be the one he plays. It might be Ramos Vinolas. I happened to catch his match last night against Pablo Carreño Busta. PCB pulled the match out in the final points in a tiebreaker, but both of them looked really good. It was the classic Spanish clay court thing going on. They were both finding their rhythm. Good depth on both wings. So Sinner coming back from Miami, and he's still young and inexperienced. I'm not sure that matchup is what you're going to get.
Yeah, that's viable. I mean, we got to think that's a 50-50 match. And so, but then again, you mentioning the two Spaniards meeting on clay, I think, Gail, that's our segue, isn't it?
Yeah. I just also want to respond though, Amy, you asked earlier on, right? Is it better to come off a run at the Miami Masters, or is it better to just be chilling in Monaco practicing on these courts? I would say it's definitely not best if you made a deep run in Marbella or a deep run in Sardinia. You know, that's where you're looking at fatigue possibly coming into play. But
good point.
Right. Miami would be 2 weeks ago instead of 1 week ago. So that's where I wouldn't favor Albert Ramos Vinolas based on that position. But it is
a short hop though, from Marbella to Bella to Monaco, or it's actually the tournament is in France. But anyway, What's funny, you guys, just a little personal aside, is that I was at Monte Carlo the last time that this tournament was played in 2019, and I got to hit on the courts. And what really struck me was that clay is not a monolith. That surface in that location had a different bounce, a different feel, a different everything than other clay surfaces that I played on. So, you know, when we speak of clay and we speak of these tournaments, we shouldn't act like all clay is created equal.
Oh no, there's Monte Carlo and there's Rome. And then once upon a time in the spring, there was Hamburg, which is very overcast. So also that's a neat thing about clay. I mean, how weather affects the bounce of the ball and the surface. No other surface is like that. So there's a whole texture to it that's very unique. Nonetheless, there will be long rallies.
Yeah. So was it windy, Amy?
No. What it was humid and cool, not freezing or anything like that. The conditions were, for me, pretty much perfect, because the day that I hit, it was not overly sunny and the light was very ambient. So the conditions that day were pretty slow.
Yeah. Well, it is considered one of the slower clay courts on the tour. I do think of it as very windy for the most part. So you must have gotten a good day. But let's talk about what this surface brings. Longer rallies generally on these kinds of slow surfaces. And Rafa Nadal has won it 11 times. Nadal, after the 2013 French Open, has a quote after he beat Djokovic, and he said, "I learned during all my career to enjoy suffering." And that is one of the things that he likens his clay success to. And it's one of the buzzwords with Nadal that you'll hear all the time from him. So we've poked around with this on this show, but we want to take a deep dive into this concept around suffering on the tennis court. Joel, how do you decipher that word as it pertains to an asset for a tennis player?
You're starting me off so I can hit a few cross court and come in and you'll pass me. because I think suffering. I talked to your coach, Gil, a while ago, Chris Lewitt, who was one of your coaches, and we'll dig into this a little bit more. And he explained to me the qualities of process that define the suffering I find valuable: hard work, persistence, focus. I think that's pretty good. I like that. I think, though, as a mindset towards a game, I don't get it. I mean, I talked about it with some pros I know, and I think suffering, real life suffering, I get it. But in tennis, I think using that as like a dichotomy between either like suffer, feel pain, or be a happy hedonist. You know, it's called work. It's called a game. Does Roger Federer suffer? Did Martina Navratilova suffer? Rod Laver, Ken Rosewall? I know what Rafa is up to as a process. Suffering from losses, I get. You know, it's like the pain of a loss, of an outcome. But in the process, I don't know. Why don't, before I rant excessively and come up with another anecdote, why don't you two share your perspectives on it as well?
Well, it's funny because in that match that I caught last night, they interviewed Pablo Carreño Busta after his win, and he said to make a final on clay, you do have to suffer a little bit. But I didn't necessarily take that to mean long grinding rallies. I feel like it was almost mental what he was talking about. So generally my perspective, since I've seen a lot of data on this and very recent data, is that the rallies on clay are, the reality of it is that the length of the rally is not that different than other surfaces, believe it or not. And so there's gotta be something more to it. You know, clay as a surface, I find to be a major grind because you have to construct points differently. And maybe that's the element of suffering. But I know that in terms of rally length, it's a myth that the rallies are, that you have more longer rallies.
I like this. Let me, before you get to more of this, Gil, I think what I see, and I'm glad you mentioned about playing on clay, it made me think of kind of a civilians on clay. The rallies may not be much longer, but the work required from the body to generate racket head speed. I mean, okay, we Americans, we play a lot on hard courts. The surface is aiding our ability to generate racket head speed. I grew up on very fast hard courts, so it's kind of like playing bumper pool. I did not grow up in the golden age of racket acceleration and torque. So when you look at the work involved, so in example, if you took, you know, recreational matches on clay, European clay compared to America, and you measured the kind of the work that has to be done to generate speed and pace and spin, that's different because the ball is slowing more. So you have to do, so maybe that's what involves the work and the suffering. And Gil, since you're our resident Spanish raised player, David Ferrer's your guy, Chris Lewitt was your guy. So why don't you give us a little peek into what suffering is or isn't?
First of all, Joel, that's a fantastic point. Because when the ball's coming slower, you do need to swing faster and harder. And you also need to move your feet more. If the ball's not coming to you quite as well, you need to make more adjustments. If the ball doesn't bounce consistently, you better move your feet more. If the ball bounces higher, you might be further behind the baseline in order to let it drop into your strike zone. So there are a lot of little micro adjustments that in the big picture lead to having to do harder work on clay. But I always looked at it like this. Some people refuse to suffer. Some people would rather just not. And sometimes that might involve using bad shot selection on the court because you want the point to end, because you start to physically feel strained. I think there's another group of people who don't like to suffer, but will actually push through it and learn how to tolerate it, a certain kind of pain tolerance. Then I think there's a third group of people who genuinely love the feeling of pain in their legs and their lungs feeling like ash. And to them, that is part of tennis and they enjoy that. And I think someone like Rafa Nadal, if you really look at his quote, he says he loves it right? So it's like, it sounds contradictory. Suffer, love it. That doesn't seem right. But I think for some people, that's what it is.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
See, I see this. I see it as a false dichotomy. I mean, I see it as a false, as a straw man dichotomy designed to validate a way of teaching the game that was originally inspired by Louis Bruguera, Sergi's father,
yep,
who loved Bjorn Borg, and pretty much focused on a fundamental premise of tennis, which is to get the ball on the court again and again and again. I'm talking about a lifetime game. I'm also talking about not just world-class players, but I'm talking about the whole game overall. I mean, so if you look at those things, like, where do you put Roger Federer? Suffer. I mean, it doesn't mean I'm not opting to suffer because I'm not, you know, I'm not bailing out of the point doesn't mean, you know, I'm going to suffer and hit another ball. It's called the work. It's called the work I put in that allows me to achieve a shot tolerance. And of course, it's not hedonistic. It's not like I'm walking around eating an ice cream cone, but I just think for a game, I mean, I'm going to use an anecdote. I'm going to share an anecdote from the world of acting. There are these two actors, Dustin Hoffman, Laurence Olivier. And they were making the movie Marathon Man. And Dustin Hoffman's character was a runner. That was his hobby. And Dustin Hoffman, and there's a Nazi backstory, there's a whole bunch of things. So they're acting on the movie and Dustin Hoffman is into the character and the character had some sleep deprivation and all this stuff. And Dustin Hoffman shows up to work one day. He says, I've been digging into this character. You know, I haven't slept and I'm feeling it. You know, it's like he was feeling the whole pain of the character. And Laurence Olivier said, well dear boy, why don't you try acting? It's called acting. I mean, it's like, yeah. It's almost as if, and it's nothing to do with who's better or not. It's almost like Federer would say to Nadal, yeah, I get that. That's important, but why don't you call it playing tennis? Playing tennis, not working tennis.
Well, I don't know. You know, someone needs to ask Roger Federer about suffering. I don't think he does it on the court much. I think he probably does it off the court in his training. I think anyone.
Well, work, I get, like I said, the hard work and, you know, and these guys, we all know all these pros.
But okay. And are they having fun? I mean, is it a nice feeling to push your body to the limit? It generally isn't.
Right. But to view it, I mean, I guess I'm speaking as someone who knows non-tennis suffering and what suffering means in life. And I don't want to get overly theological here.
Okay.
But what is suffer? And this is a game. I mean, sure, of course, the work, the pain of it, but suffer. I mean, it'd be interesting. We should get people from different religions to address this course to speak of what that all means to really suffer. And I get it with Nadal. I mean, I love Nadal and I love Jimmy Connors, and these guys are the workhorses, competitors, tenacious warriors of the game. But to view it as suffering also from a view of taking a lifetime longevity mode of playing. For example, I would never urge a non-pro to view that they need to suffer so they could win the men's 45 sectional championships. That doesn't mean they should be a hedonist. That doesn't mean they shouldn't hit extra practice serves or do drills, but is that suffering?
Well, I think maybe a better term is willing to engage in an element of delayed gratification, where you're training hard and it's not pleasant and you don't enjoy it, but boy, does it feel good when you get into the match and you're in a tough spot or you're in a long match and you realize that the preparation that you've done off the court has made you feel not as bad as you possibly could.
I love that, the delay of gratification, because you know, yeah, I put in the work. Yeah, 8 balls, 10 balls, it's all good. I don't feel the need to bail out. Now it's 3-all in the third set. I'm all right. I'm all right. And that's, you know, that's like the Australian goal. Like Roy Emerson said, you want to, can you feel as fresh in the fifth set as you did in the first? And that comes from work.
This is great. I completely respect the thought that it might be the wrong word. But let me take a different angle at this. Sometimes even on the match court, you're going to be past your fitness limit. It's just not going to matter,
yes.
Right? It's
yes.
always somewhere. So if I take yes. the most famous example of an instance where two of our three, Nadal and Djokovic, were just, it was a day that, boy, neither of them wanted to lose. And I'm thinking of the 2012 Australian Open final. And that match embodies what Nadal would call suffering for sure. If either of those players didn't have a willingness to really feel a lot of pain on the court, it wouldn't have lasted 6 hours. Do we agree with that?
Yeah.
Well, that's right. I knew you're headed to that one. That's right. A nearly 6 hour slam match where neither could stand during the awards. And I think that was pretty amazing. I mean, just incredible. You're right. And they had put in the effort that allowed them to have the opportunity to suffer in competition, you know, to put in the, because if they hadn't put in, there's no way they could have done that if they hadn't each been tremendous at their training and practice and fitness and off court and the whole thing. Remember, Amy, I think you shared this a few weeks ago, Nadal's television viewing pattern where he plays the point and then
he gets on the treadmill, and then when the ball's dead he walks, and when it's live he just gives it everything he can, and throughout an entire match.
Right. And so yeah. this whole thing, you're right, of finding of work, and I guess I liked Amy's thing of delay gratification. And of course, there's going to be pain. I think kind of the message around suffer, as if that's the pinnacle word. I come back to this being, this is a game. It reminds me of a friend I was playing with one day, and he was getting frustrated at his tennis. And I walked over to him. I said, "All right, hey," I didn't say, "let's work tennis Thursday afternoon." You know, I mean, Amy, you're right. A mom.
Yes.
You know, your kids, there's time for work, there's time for play. And I'm not saying pro tennis or any tennis is a sandbox and just laugh and la, la, la. Believe me, if you watched me play a match, you would know that. I mean, I don't talk, I'm like a monk. So. Need to play and let it come out. Cause there's also like with Rafa, there's a joy he brings to competition too. It's not the joy of being at a birthday party, but it's the joy of competition, the joy of effort.
Right. And that does come down a lot to what we're talking about that gratification at the end. So the work you put in does kind of pay off. And that's probably not true for a lot of other types of suffering, if we're really delving into what the word means. But let's get into kind of the recreational side. And I also want to tell a story, which I've not told to, I haven't told this to many people, actually. After the first day at Chris Lewitt Tennis Academy, and you know, I was pretty young, but I cried and I was like, I can't do that every day. Because you know, it's a long day with two fitness blocks. And I was just like, no, that was way too hard. I definitely can't do that. And I won't, you know, I just didn't think I could actually, you know, ultimately doing it. And my body got used to it, which is what happens. And you really just got to get through the first week, which is really, really difficult. And it gets easier after that. Mm-hmm. After doing something that you're so sure that you can't do, there's like no better feeling in the world. And I credit tennis in a lot of ways, really teaching me what hard work is.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Joel said, I'm a mom. So therefore I should have perspective, but I too have left the court in tears. And, you know, it does take on a metaphoric significance. You know, this is a metaphor for my life, and this can teach me things that are, there are parallels in life. And, you know, it reminds me just a few months ago, my coach was watching me play points and he said, you know, what happened to you on that point? You just sort of fizzled. And I said, actually, I was working so hard and running so hard that I felt like I was going to throw up. And he said, well, you need to train so that you don't feel that way, you know, start running, start doing this. So I think that, you know, is that teaches you, you know, just like you said, Gil, there are parallels.
Well, yeah. And the gratification part, I think I want to point out is not just the, I think a way to conduct one's attitude through the match. There's the gratification, obviously, of the desired outcome at the end of the match. But throughout the match, we find signs of gratification. I think like Nadal does too. They're called points, whether it's the point we win, which should always be a form of a positive gratification, not, oh God, can't believe I won the point with that shot. You know, it's interesting the signals people send to themselves about how they don't always reward themselves emotionally, attitudinally. You know, oh my God, I got away with that one. It's like, no, you won the point. And then, and then there are occasional points where, wow, that was a really good point. And they really came up with something. So, okay. And then there's the sliver that we all know of the one, like I know some shots I'll miss and I'll think, oh my God, all those lessons. I took all those lessons and I missed that one again. the familiar butchered shot, which I'm not going to reveal in this show, but, so to me, I guess, if it's suffering, if it's in the back of your head out there, that's fine. But along the way, there needs to be the positive mentality, the positive aspect of, okay, next point, on to the next point, instead of, instead of, this is painful.
Yeah, tennis certainly shouldn't be like that. Is there a difference between physical suffering and mental suffering? And is one a lot more tolerable or, you know,
one is a lot more fixable in the short term.
Uh-huh.
Mental is a lot more fixable in the short term. Physical will then affect, you know, physical is the core of it. I mean, it's like, you guys live in far more drastic weather than I do on the East Coast. I mean, I think, Amy, didn't you tell me about a match you played a few months ago? It was like 100, I mean, a tournament you were playing last year or something is really hot and just unbelievable.
Yeah, that was they made us play indoors in the middle of the summer at a club that didn't have air conditioning.
Oh no.
And that it was a tournament. We were all packed in there and it was like 100 degrees and people were passing out and the ambulance was called. And but for me, the mental and the physical are all, and the tactical suffering, whatever, it's all tied together. It's like a big mishmash. So it's interesting that you guys sort of categorize, you know.
I see how they become the circle of things.
I want to say why I categorize, because I don't believe in mental suffering. I really only believe in physical suffering. I think the whole point is that I don't think Nadal is suffering mentally when he's suffering physically. I think he feels like he's at home. This is, you know, this is his office. That, you know, that's the distinction.
Oh, see, it's funny. See, I see them connected, but I think if the physical is going, the mental is pretty much going to cascade. The mental is control. See, to me, the mental is massively controllable. Massively controllable. And therefore, you know, you're not going to be at the mercy of it. But the physical, the times when I think of matches where I've like tired and then everything starts to kind of disintegrate from there, the shot selection, the bailing out, the energy, you know, the hand is slipping off the grip, you know, it's just like it feels like in a dance marathon.
Mm-hmm. As we've been doing this show, I think there have been a couple times where we've thought to ourselves, well, this would be a really good question to ask one of the three, but this conversation is one of the strongest examples of that for me. I would love to see what Roger Federer thinks of Nadal's suffering. And I would love to ask Roger, the way Nadal describes suffering on the court, do you have that? Do you do that? And I'm not really sure what his answer would be.
I think the way to do it would be to not mention Nadal. It's like, Amy, you're the social scientist, so help me with this.
Yeah, how would we ask that?
The unaided thing, which is, Hello, Mr. Three. Suffering is a concept often discussed in tennis. Discuss, you know, you just kind of lay it out there like an like a hand feed, and then let them each give their kind of like verbiage on it. I don't know. What do you think, Amy?
I mean, I've mentioned this on the show a few times that I did get to ask Federer about rally length and if, you know, his thoughts basically on playing longer points. And, you know, his answer was that he doesn't like to play longer points. So maybe for him, a long point on clay is not fun. But the way he ended it is like so money, because he says, but you have to be willing to do it. So in other words, you have to override what your preference is with an all-out willingness to do that. So I think what he was saying was that's how he kind of conquered that.
Well, and that makes total sense given his developmental path. I mean, we've spread a lot about the portrait of the young Roger and the players he liked and the environment he was in and his sense of how he wanted to go about crafting a style. So you got one guy in Roger who probably had to learn to play longer points and Rafa who had to learn how to play shorter points as he advanced his career.
All right. Well, hopefully you didn't do too much suffering as you listened to this episode of Three, but that'll do it. Make sure if you're watching on YouTube that you leave the video a like. If you have anything good to say, please don't hesitate to share in the comments section. We are available on all podcast platforms, and it's a huge help if you leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. And we will see you next time on the next episode of Three.